25. The clouds came up in the night, and the morning was overcast and muggy. We had bacon and eggs for breakfast in the bar of the motel. The owner's wife made us sandwiches for a picnic and gave us ice for the esky. Arkady again called the hospital.
"I still won't say what's wrong," he said as he hung up. "I think it's bad."
We debated whether to go back to Alice, but there was nothing we could do, so we decided to press on to Cullen. Arkady spread the map over the table. The drive, he calculated, would take 2 days. We'd cut across country and spend the night at Popanji, and then go on to Cullen. The woman drinking coffee at the next banquette overheard us and asked apologetically if by any chance we were going past Lombardy Downs. Arkady glanced at the map.
"It's on the way," he said. "Can we give you a lift?"
"Oh, no," the woman cringed. "No, no, I don't want to go there. I wondered if you'd take something for me, a letter." She was an awkward, frayed young woman with lackluster hair and unswerving amber eyes. She enunciated her syllables in a ladylike fashion and wore a fawn-coloured dress with long sleeves. "I've got it written," she said. "You wouldn't mind, would you? I'll go and fetch it if you—"
"Of course we'll take it," said Arkady.
She ran off and came running back, out of breath, with the letter. She pushed it away from her, vehemently, onto the table. Then she began to finger a tiny gold crucifix around her neck. "It's for Bill Muldoon," she said, staring dully at the name on the envelope. "He's station manager at Lombardy. He's my husband. Ask anyone to give it to him, but if you see him, if he asks you if you've seen me, tell him I'm well." She looked frail and miserable and sick. "Don't worry," I said. "We will." "Thanks," she said in a constricted voice, and sat down to finish her coffee. We drove for 3 hours across a featureless plain. Showers had fallen in the night and laid the dust on the road. We saw some emus a long way off. The wind was rising. We saw something swinging from a solitary tree. It was a huge knitted teddy bear, with royal blue trousers and a scarlet cap. Someone had slashed it at the neck and the kapok stuffing was spilling out. On the ground there was a cross made from twigs, rubbed with ochre, and its arms lashed together with hair string. I picked up the cross and held it out to Arkady.
"Aboriginal business," he said. "I wouldn't touch that if I were you."
I dropped it and got back into my seat. Up ahead the sky was darkening.
"It could be," said Arkady, "that we're in for a storm."
We turned off at the sign marked Lombardy Downs. After a mile or so, the track skirted round the end of a runway. An orange windsock blew horizontally in the whirring wind, and there was a light aircraft in the distance. The man who owned the station owned an airline. The homestead was a sprawling white house set back among some stunted trees, but closer to the strip there was a smaller brick-built house alongside an open hangar. In the hangar were housed the owner's collection of vintage aeroplanes and cars. Parked beside a Tiger Moth were a Model T Ford and a Rolls-Royce farm truck, its wooden sides painted brown with black trim. I told Arkady my father's story about the Rolls-Royce and the sheep millionaire. "Not so far-fetched after all," I said. A blousy woman appeared at the door in a green-spotted housecoat. Her blonde hair was up in curlers.
"You boys looking for someone?" she called out.
"Bill Muldoon," I called back against the wind. "We've got a letter for him."
"Muldoon's out," she said. "Come on in, and I'll make you a coffee."
We went into a messy kitchen. Arkady put the letter on the table, on the red checked oilcloth cover, next to some women's magazines. We sat down. An oil painting of Ayers Rock hung aslant on the wall. The woman glanced at the writing on the envelope and shrugged. She was the other woman. While the kettle boiled, she unwrapped a half-eaten candy bar, nibbled off an inch or so, wrapped it up again, and licked the chocolate off her lips.
"God, I am bored," she said.
The owner of the station, she told us, had flown up from Sydney for the weekend, so Muldoon was on call. She poured out our coffees and said again that she was bored. We were on the point of leaving when Muldoon came in, an athletic, red-faced man, dressed from head to foot in black. Black hat, boots, jeans, and a black shirt open to the navel. He imagined we had come on business and shook our hands. The instant he saw the letter, he paled and clenched his jaw.
"Get out of here," he said.
We left.
Unfriendly, I said. The pastoral ethic, said Arcady, same the world over.
Half an hour later we crossed a cattle grid, which marked the end of Lombardy Downs. We had narrowly missed a cloudburst and watched the shoots of rain slanting sideways towards a line of hills. We then joined the road from Alice to Poppengee. The sides of the road were littered with abandoned cars, usually upside down in heaps of broken glass. We stopped beside a rusty blue Ford with a black woman squatting beside it. The bonnet was open, and a small boy, naked, stood sentinel on the roof.
"What's up?"
Arcady leaned from the window.
"Plugs," said the woman. "Gone to get new plugs."
"Who has?"
"He has."
"Where to?"
"The Alice."
"How long's he been gone?"
3 days.
"You all right there?"
"Yup,"
the woman sniffed.
"You got water and everything?"
"Yup."
"You want a sandwich?"
"Yup."
We gave the woman and boy 3 sandwiches. They grabbed them and ate them greedily.
"You sure you're all right then?" Arcady persisted.
"Yup,"
the woman nodded.
"We can take you back to Poppengee."
She gave a grumpy shake of the head and waved us away. Around lunchtime we crossed a creek with river-red gums growing in its bed. It was a good place to picnic. We picked our way over water-worn boulders and pools of stagnant yellow water with leaves afloat on the surface. The country to the west was grey and treeless, and cloud shadows were moving across it. There were no cattle, no fences, no wind pumps. This country was too arid for grazing. We had left behind the cow shit. There were no more flies. As we walked up to one of the gum trees, a flock of black cockatoos flew out squawking like rusty hinges and settled on a dead gum up ahead. I took out my glasses and saw the flash of scarlet feathers glowing under their tails. We spread the picnic in the shade. The sandwiches were uneatable, so we chucked them to the crows, but we had biscuits and cheese, olives and a can of sardines, and 5 cold beers between us. We talked politics, books, and Russian books. He said how strange it was to feel oneself Russian in a country of Anglo-Saxon prejudice. Spend an evening in a room full of Sydney intellectuals, and they'd all end up dissecting some obscure event within the first penal settlement. He looked around at the immense sweep of country.
"Pity we didn't get here first," he said.
"We the Russians."
"Not only Russians," he shook his head, "Slavs, Hungarians, Germans even. Any people who could cope with wide horizons. Too much of this country went to islanders. They never understood it. They're afraid of space. We," he added, "could have been proud of it, loved it for what it was. I don't think we'd have sold it off so easily."
"Yes," I said. "Why in this country of untold resources do Australians go on selling them off to foreigners?"
"They'd sell off anything," he shrugged.
He then changed the subject and asked if ever on my travels I'd been with a hunting people. "Once," I said, "in Mauritania."
"Where's that?"
"The Western Sahara. They weren't so much a hunting tribe as a hunting caste. They were called the Namadi."
"And hunted?"
"Oryx and Arax antelopes," I said, "with dogs." In the city of Walata, once a capital of the Almoravid Empire, and now a jumble of blood-coloured courtyards, I spent 3 whole days pestering the governor to allow me to meet the Namadi. The governor, a morose hypochondriac, had been longing for someone to share the memory of his student days in Paris, or to argue doctrinal points of La Pensée Mao Tse-Tungien. His favourite words were tactique and technique, but whenever I raised the question of the Namadi, he'd let fly a brittle laugh and murmur,
"It is forbidden."
At mealtimes, a pink-fingered lutenist would serenade us through the couscous while the governor reconstructed, with my prompting, a street map of the Quartier Latin. From his palace, if 4 mud-brick rooms were a palace, I could see a tiny white tent of the Namadi beckoning me across the hillside.
"But why do you wish to see these people?"
the governor shouted at me.
"Walata, yes. Walata is a historical place, but this Namadi is nothing. It is a dirty people."
Not only were they dirty, they were a national disgrace. They were infidels, idiots, thieves, parasites, liars. They ate forbidden food.
"And their women," he added, "are prostitutes."
"But beautiful," I suggested, if only to annoy him. His hand shot out from the folds of his blue robes.
Ha! He wagged a finger at me. Now I know. Now I see it. But let me tell you, young Englishman, those women have terrible diseases, incurable diseases.
That's not what I heard, I said. On our third evening together, having browbeaten him with the name of the Minister of the Interior, I saw signs he was beginning to relent. At lunch the day after, he said I was free to go, providing I was accompanied by a policeman, and providing I did nothing which might encourage them to hunt.
They must not hunt, he bellowed. Do you hear me?
I do hear you, I said, but they are hunters. They were hunting before the time of the Prophet. What else can they do but hunt?
Hunting,
he folded his fingers sententiously,
is forbidden by the law of our republic.
A few weeks earlier, as I was rooting through the literature on Sahara nomads, I had come across an account of the Nemadi, based on the findings of a Swiss ethnologist, which classed them among the most destitute people on earth. They were thought to number about 300, and they would wander, in bands of 30 or so, along the edge of El Jouf, the Saharan empty quarter. The report gave them fair skin and blue eyes, and assigned them to the eighth and lowest grade of Moorish society, outcasts of the wilderness. Lower than the Haritin, who were tied black agricultural slaves. The Nemadi professed neither food taboos nor reverence for Islam. They ate locusts and wild honey and wild boar if they got the chance. They sometimes earned a pittance from the nomads by selling tikhta, the dried meat of antelopes, which when crumbled gives a gamey flavour to couscous. The men earned a little more money carving saddle trees and milk bowls from acacia wood. They insisted they were the rightful owners of the land and that the Moors had stolen it from them. Because the Moors treated them as pariahs, they were forced to camp far from the town. As for their origins, they were possibly survivors of a Mesolithic hunting population. Almost certainly, they were the Mesufites, one of whom, blind in one eye, half-blind in the other, guided Ibn Battuta across the sands in 1357. The desert here, wrote the world traveller, is beautiful and brilliant, and the soul finds its ease. Antelopes abound. A herd often passes so close to our caravan that the Mesufites hunt them with arrows and with dogs. By the 1970s, shooting parties with Land Rovers and long-range rifles had made sure that the oryx and addax, far from being abundant, were dying out. The government called for a general ban on hunting, in which the Nemadi were included. Knowing themselves to be as gentle as the Moors were violent and vindictive, knowing also that it was herding which led to violence, the Nemadi wanted none of it. Their favourite songs spoke of flights into the desert, where they would wait for better times. The governor told me how he and his colleagues had bought the Nemadi a total of 1,000 goats.
1,000 goats! He went on shouting. You know what that means? Many goats. And what did they do with those goats? Milk them? No, ate them. Ate the lot. Ils sont imbéciles.
The policeman, I'm glad to say, liked the Nemadi. He said they were brave gens, and surreptitiously that the governor was off his head. Walking towards the white tent, we first heard the sound of laughter, and then came on a party of 12 Nemadi, adults and children, resting in the shade of an acacia. They were none of them sick or dirty. Everyone was immaculate. The headman got up to welcome us. Mafuld, I said, and shook his hand. I knew his face from the Swiss ethnographer's photos, a flat, beaming face, wound about with a cornflower blue turban. He had hardly aged in 20 years. Among the party were several women in indigo cotton and a negro with a club foot. There was an ancient, blue-eyed cripple who manoeuvred himself on his hands. The chief hunter was a square-shouldered man whose expression spoke of rigour and reckless gaiety. He was whittling a saddle tree from a block of wood, while his favourite dog, a sleek, piebald terrier not unlike a Jack Russell, nuzzled up against his knee. Nemadi means master of dogs. The dogs are said to eat even when their owners go hungry. Their training would be the pride of any circus. A pack consists of 5, the king and 4 followers. The hunter, having tracked a herd of antelopes to its grazing ground, will lie with his dogs on the downward scarp of a dune, and instruct them which animal to go for. At a signal, the king then hurtles down the slope, fastens its teeth around the antelope's muzzle, and the others go for each of the legs. A single knife thrust, a rapid prayer, to ask the antelope for its forgiveness, and the hunt is over. The Namadi despise the use of firearms as a sacrilege, and since the soul of the dead beast is thought to reside in its bones, these are reverently buried in case the dogs defile them. "The antelopes were our friends," said one of the women with a dazzling white smile. "Now they have gone far away. We have nothing, nothing to do but laugh." They all roared with laughter when I asked about the governor's goats. "And if you will buy us a goat," said the chief hunter, "we will kill that also and eat it." "Right," I said to the policeman. "Let's go and buy them a goat." We walked across the wadi to where a herdsman was watering his flock. I paid a little more than he asked for a yearling, and the hunter coaxed it back to the camp. A gurgle from behind a bush announced that its life had ended, and there would be meat for supper. The women laughed, beat a tam-tam on some old tin basins, and sang a soft burbling song to thank the foreigner for the gift of meat. There is a story of a Moorish emir who, driven to frenzy by a Namadi woman's smile, kidnapped her, clothed her in silks, and never saw her smile again until the day she spotted through the lattice of her prison a Namadi man strolling through the market. To the emir's credit, he let her go. "What," I asked the women, "was the secret of their famous smile?" "Meat," they cried cheerfully, gnashing their teeth in unison. "Meat is what gives us our beautiful smiles. We chew the meat, and we cannot help smiling." In the little white tent, sewn from strips of Sudanese cotton, there lived an old woman with two dogs and a cat. Her name was Lemina. She was very old when the Swiss came nearly 20 years earlier. The policeman said she was more than 100. Tall and unstooping in blue, she came through the thorn trees towards the cause of the excitement. Marfould stood to greet her. She was deaf and dumb. They stood against the deepening sky, flicking their fingers in sign language. Her skin was white, like sheets of tissue paper. Her eyes were hooded and cloudy. Smiling, she raised her withered arms towards me and uttered a succession of warbling notes. She held the smile a full 3 minutes. Then she turned on her heels, snapped a twig from an acacia, and went back to her tent. Among these pale-skinned people, the Negro was the odd man out. I asked how he had come to join the band. "He was alone," said Marfould, "so he came with us." I then learned through the policeman that it was possible for a man to join the Namadi, a woman never. Yet since their numbers were so low, and since no self-respecting outsider would demean himself by marrying down, these women always had their eyes open for fresh white blood. One of the young mothers, a grave and lovely girl with a cowl of blue cotton over her head, was suckling a baby. She was married to the hunter. You would have said she was about 25, but when I mentioned the name of the Swiss ethnologist, the husband grinned and, gesturing towards his wife, said, "We have one of his." He set aside his carpentry and whistled across to the second camp. A minute or two later, a lithe, bronze-skinned young man with glinting green eyes came striding through the bushes with a pair of dogs and a hunting spear. He wore a short leather breech clout. His hair was fair to reddish and cut in a kind of coxcomb. The instant he saw a European, he lowered his eyelids. He sat down in silence between his mother and foster father. Anyone might mistake them for the Holy Family. When I came to the end of the story, Arkady made no comment but stood up and said, "We'd better get going." We buried the debris and walked back to the car. "You may think it sounds silly," I said, trying to pump him for a reaction, "but I live with that old woman's smile." The smile, I said, was like a message from the Golden Age. It had taught me to reject out of hand all arguments for the nastiness of human nature. The idea of returning to an original simplicity was not naive or unscientific or out of touch with reality. "Renunciation," I said, "even at this late date, can work." "I'd agree with that," said Arkady. "The world, if it has a future, has an ascetic future.